Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. Almost 30,000 Americans commit suicide every year. Another 750,000 attempt it. It is particularly a problem among young people, and the rate of suicide among the youth has been going up. In fact, the suicide rate, for example, for white males between 15 and 24 has tripled since 1950. Suicide kills more adolescents and college students than cancer, heart disease, lung disease, diabetes, strokes, and AIDS combined. This morning, in this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a guest who has written quite a bit on mood disorders and suicide, and is the author of a new book, in fact, that looks at suicide, and specifically suicide among people under 40. Our guest is Kay Redfield Jamison. She's professor of psychiatry at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. She is the author of the book that we'll be talking about. The title is Night Falls Fast, Understanding Suicide, and it's now available in a paperback edition published by Vintage Books. In addition to this book, she's the co-author of the standard medical text on manic depressive illness. She has authored a book titled Touched by Fire, Manic Depressive Illness and the Artistic Temperament. And also, she's authored a memoir about her own experiences with manic depressive illness. That book is titled An Unquiet Mind. She's talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, we certainly encourage you to call in. Perhaps you'll have some questions of your own to ask. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief. And we ask that so that we can accommodate as many different people as possible and kind of keep things moving along. But anyone's certainly welcome to join the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And if you match the numbers with the letters on the phone, you get WILL. Which may or may not be easier, 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Jamison, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Well, thank you.
I found your book very, very interesting, maybe a little troubling. One reaction I had to it, and this certainly is not intended as a criticism, but just a commentary on just how complex a subject it is, I'm not sure that if one went to this book looking for an answer to the question, why do people commit suicide, whether it would be there. And I'm not sure that I think maybe that's because no one really has the answer to that question, not a definitive answer.
Well, I don't think we have a definitive answer, but we certainly have a lot of knowledge. And I think we know that it's really very clearly linked to one of several major psychiatric illnesses, particularly depression and particularly depressive illnesses associated with alcohol and drug abuse. So I think we do have a lot of understanding about what causes it. We have a lot of psychological and biological understanding of it, and we certainly know that really bad stress in the environment coupled with a bad psychiatric illness can make the difference.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm thinking about it in the sense that it does seem to be true that we know a lot about risk factors,
right?
But what it is that then pushes the person to take that action is that indeed something that we do understand?
Well, I think we know a lot about certainly psychological aspects of why people kill themselves. I think that if you look at everything from suicide notes, which focus on just unendurable pain. I simply couldn't stand it anymore, which is far and away the most common single remark that's made in a suicide note, that there's just an unendurable level of suffering involved and occasionally an impulsive component, but it's almost always rooted in depression or other psychiatric illnesses.
One of the things that you point out in the book is that suicide is something that we do indeed see all over the world, and that also it is consistently skewed toward the young. Over the past 50 years, suicide rates around the world for young people, especially those under 25, have been going up.
Yes, very definitely, although they've begun to taper off a bit in very recent years, probably due to the fact that we're beginning to recognize and treat depression earlier than we used to. But there's no question that it is a major killer of the young, and it's certainly in college-age kids, it is the second major cause of death.
Yeah. And having made that point, we also ought to underline this to make sure people understand that, generally speaking, children do not commit suicide. That what we see is a big jump when people get to puberty. Why do we think that is?
Well, again, one of the things that we know about all of the major psychiatric illnesses that are associated with suicide in around the world is that they begin to kick in at puberty. And the average age of onset, for example, of bipolar or manic depressive illness is about 17 or 18. Of major depression, slightly older. Of schizophrenia, about 19. Substance abuse, slightly younger. So all of the major mental illnesses that are associated with suicide begin to first appear at puberty. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't kids who kill themselves earlier. And in fact, there's been a quite frightening increase in 10 to 14-year-olds in suicide rates. But as you say, it's relatively quite unusual. Hmm.
Do we think that that is in some way a biological issue that is somehow related to maturation, or is it more a sense that that is a point where people are coming to be more, I don't know, maybe more reflective, more self-critical, and that it has to do with, in a sense, it's not so much chemical as it is psychological, and it has to do with personality and other sorts of issues like that.
Well, I think overwhelmingly the clinical evidence and scientific evidence is that it's related to, you know, probably changes that are going on in the brain, hormonal changes, maturational changes. But certainly psychological issues are extremely important, and they're not, you know, it's not either or. They're very closely linked to one another. The brain and the mind are, you know, not separate, so that they are so closely tied that a lot of what we see as temperament, for example, we know is, largely genetically determined. That doesn't mean that there aren't huge influences from the outside, but it does mean that certain temperaments that we know that are more likely to result in suicide, very volatile, impulsive, occasionally violent temperaments, that these people seem to have that, as it were, wiring from the time they are very, very young. And you can see this in 18-month-old infants. And that tends to be a fairly characteristic temperament pattern that goes on throughout the person's lifetime.
Hmm. And does having a close family member who has committed suicide or attempted suicide put one at greater risk?
Yes, certainly. Yes. I mean, we know that there's a genetic component to suicide that's in addition to the fact that the major psychiatric illnesses have a very strong genetic component. Severe depression tends to run in families. Bipolar illness very, very much runs in families. Schizophrenia runs in families. We know these things. But in addition to that, there's some families in which suicide and the mental illness go together, and that is does put people at higher risk. And that also means that you have more information so you can hopefully diagnose and treat that person, because we know that these illnesses are all very treatable.
I have a caller, and we'll get right to that person. I want to promise them we won't make them wait too much longer. There's just, at this point, one other question that I want to raise. You certainly make the case in the book that particularly suicide among young people is a very serious public health problem.
Yes.
And at the same time, in the epilogue to the book, you pose the question, why is it that as a society, we all aren't more concerned about this?
Absolutely. I mean, it is amazing, really. I mean, you don't hear the kind of public concern and public outrage for suicide, despite the fact that it kills so many young people every year. I think that we just have not talked about suicide because of the stigma about suicide and also the stigma about the illnesses that lead up to suicide.
Well, that was my next sort of thought, that it seems that we are very, very uncomfortable talking about, thinking about dealing with mental illness generally, so maybe we shouldn't be surprised that because this is so closely connected that it would be, again, something that we'd just rather not think about.
I think that's absolutely true, and we'd prefer not to think about it, but I think we can't afford not to think about it.
Let me, again, introduce at this point our guest, reintroduce our guest. We're speaking with Kay Redfield Jamison. She's professor of psychiatry at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and has written quite a lot about mood disorders and about suicide. She's the author of a fairly recently published book, which is titled Night Falls Fast, Understanding Suicide. And it's now out in a paperback edition published by Vintage. So not terribly expensive if you're interested in reading on the subject. And, of course, you can call in here, talk with us if you have a question. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller to talk with us in Champaign, and it's line one. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I've been diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic for 23 years,
mm-hmm.
and I attempted suicide three times back around 1980, 1985, and 1990, and I thank God that I'm here today to enjoy this day because, you know, sometimes things look really bad, but, you know, things pass and things get better. And there's a country song on the radio these days, and the woman sings that we have teenagers living in a culture of darkness together alone. And, you know, I know how painful it can be to how it can feel to feel isolated and alone even around lots of other people. And, you know, I think with the kids in our community, if we could, you know, somehow kind of address the issues that, you know, the kids aren't alone. The kids that are having a tough time, they're not alone in that. And if they can allow some time to pass, things will get better. And I think the main thing to consider in, you know, in kids having tough times these days is we have to instill in them that there is reason to hope that, you know, things will get better. That's about all I had to say.
Well, you know, first of all, I'm delighted you are here today too. I mean, I'm very, very glad about that. And I couldn't agree with you more about the importance of hope. And I think, you know, you were saying that you suffer from schizophrenia, which is, you know, a terribly painful illness, but it is exactly an example of how hopeful things have become. I think over the last 5 or 10 years, the advances in treatment for your illness and for depression and manic depression and other psychiatric illnesses is just terrific. And we can now say in all honesty that there is an enormous amount of hope that we can extend to people who are feeling suicidal and who are feeling hopeless. So I'm delighted that you feel that way.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the call. It raises several questions, several points in my mind. And I guess one of them is that people who are severely depressed and then who may go on to attempt suicide or to commit suicide, I think that part of what characterizes their emotional state is a sense of hopelessness.
Absolutely.
That is this feeling that it will never get better.
That's right.
And one wonders how it is how you get someone to go from that point to the place where the caller was talking about, where even though things might seem to be very, very bad, you can hold on to some tiny bit of hope that, in fact, this will pass and that it is possible for things to get better.
Well, it's very hard because one of the first things that goes when you get depressed is a sense of hope. So that even though you may know rationally that your depression might respond to treatment, you question whether, in fact, it will. And so you give up. And I think it requires that other people really are pretty forceful in terms of reaching out and in terms of getting people into treatment. And that's not always easy to do. And one of the reasons why I and many, many people who study suicide and suicide prevention in particular are eager for parents to learn about the symptoms of depression long before their kids ever reach an age where they're going to be at risk for depression, so that they can talk to kids in the same way that you would talk to them about drugs or sex or anything else and say, look, you know, these are the symptoms of depression. The odds are you won't get depressed. But if you do, one of the first things that happens is you might feel like there's no point in living, or that you might feel that there's no hope. And these are the symptoms. Come to me. There is a lot that can be done. We can get help together. You can see a doctor. You can get treatment. You know, so that there, it's long before a person gets so sick that they can't even respond to the possibility of hope, that you've kind of paved the road for them. And I think we need to do that as a society. We have to think prevention rather than just, you know, intervention. Hmm.
That, I guess that gets at another sort of question. That is, are there clear signs, and are there times when perhaps if we're talking about peers or we're talking about parents, that we aren't paying attention and that we're missing things? Is it subtle, or is it really obvious, and there shouldn't really be an excuse for missing the signs?
Well, I think both, in a way. I think that, you know, saying that there's not an excuse, it assumes that we as a society have done a better job in educating people than we have, because most people may see that there's something wrong with a child but not know what it is because they don't have any context for it. And I think that most kids who are depressed or at risk for suicide do give off some sort of signal. And in fact, psychological autopsy studies suggest that maybe 60% of people who kill themselves actually have told someone outright that they plan to kill themselves, whether it's a doctor or a minister or a family member or a friend. And sometimes that warning just isn't taken seriously enough. Sometimes it's, you know, just ignored because none of us wants to believe that that's true about somebody we really care about. But in children and in young people, you know, often you'll see a pattern of grades may begin to slip. A child may begin to withdraw from friends or get very much more irritable and short-tempered, and be, you know, kind of moping around or using alcohol or drugs. And these are things to be concerned about. Very impulsive, particularly kids who are acting in a very withdrawn sort of way, in a depressed sort of way, you need to really reach out to them. And doctors need to be more aware of this. You know, pediatricians need to be more aware of it, because actually pediatricians are the ones who often see the kids when they are coming in because they say, I'm tired, I've got some sort of physical illness, and in fact they're tired because they're depressed.
Mm-hmm. And I think you just touch on something that's probably important. That is, I think that many people have this idea that if people talk about suicide, that means that they're not really going to do it. And I think people who study suicide and psychologists say, no, in fact, that's very serious. If someone is talking about suicide, you really should pay attention to that.
Absolutely. There's no question about it. As I say, the majority of people who commit suicide have said outright that they plan to kill themselves or want to die. You know, obviously there are degrees of severity of pain and of intent to die, but always these things should be taken seriously, no question about it.
We have some other folks to talk with. Next is Aurora, and it's line 4.
Yes, I have a friend that's very depressed. I've known it since 85, and 3 years ago she called me from the East Coast to tell me that she wanted to kill herself. So I called her sons then and told them, and they said, oh, she's talked like that for years, and I felt I'd done what I could. Last year she called, and this time I called her daughter, who was a nurse, and tried to intercede as much as I could. I gave her books to read, and I think that's one of the most difficult things. These people are so depressed they can't read to get themselves out of it, or, you know, that kind of thing. But I read the books and got a lot out of them. You just gave the signs of depression, And now she has had a huge loss in her life. She's had to move and has all the stresses of moving to a place that she didn't want to move to. And I called her up a couple of days ago, and she called me up, and I told her I'd call her up over the weekend. I just wondered how, you know, I'll give her the empathic response when I can. I don't know what else to say. She's had every treatment. She just had electric shock treatment. What do they call it these days, electric shock? I understand they don't call it that anymore.
Electroconvulsive therapy sometimes, also electroshock. They call it both.
Oh, do they call it? Because she had it many years ago, and then she had it last January again.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't seem to have done the trick for her this either time.
Mm-hmm.
So she has a son who's a surgeon also, so she's really had a lot of therapies. And I guess I was just calling you to see if there was anything that you thought that I could say or do or what. I've tried with phone calls.
Well, it sounds like you've been a terrific friend and have reached out. It is very difficult with some people who are, you know, very chronically and profoundly depressed to reach them if they don't respond to treatment. I should say that, you know, most people, the overwhelming majority of people, do respond to treatment for depression. Every now and then somebody will not, just like with other illnesses. There are occasionally people who don't respond to other treatments, or maybe every treatment hasn't been tried. But overwhelmingly with depression, it's actually one of the most treatable disorders in all of medicine. So just for context, for people who might be listening, it's important to stress that. But having said that, it is extremely upsetting to try and reach out to someone and not be able to feel like you're getting through. I mean, I understand that's a very hard thing to do, but it sounds like you've been a terrific friend.
Well, could I ask you just two more things? Should I talk about things that obviously are very painful? She had to move out of a lovely home into a city apartment, which she didn't want to do, and she had to give up her two dogs, which she didn't want to do either. Those are very painful things to her, and I don't know whether I should discuss this with her, you know, say, well, how did you make out? Did your dogs move with you? Or I don't know. Should I avoid those subjects? I don't know what to talk about.
I would just ask her what she's comfortable talking about. You know, I would leave it up to her to say it must be upsetting for you. Do you want to talk about it, or would you prefer not to talk about it?
Thank you so much.
Sure.
All right. Thank you for the call. We are at our midpoint here and have another caller, and we'll get them in just a moment. But I do want to introduce again, for anybody who might have tuned in the last little bit here, our guest. We're talking with Kay Redfield Jamison. She's professor of psychiatry at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. She has she's the author or co-author of 5 books and many articles that deal with mood disorders, suicide, psychotherapy, and also the drug lithium. She's written a memoir about her own experiences with manic depressive illness. That book is titled An Unquiet Mind. And if you're interested in reading more on the subject of suicide, the most recent book that she's done is titled Night Falls Fast, Understanding Suicide. It's now available in a paperback edition published by Vintage. Questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Here's another Champaign person. It's line one. Hello?
I had a question about sort of where the medical establishment is now on diagnosis, age of diagnosis. You mentioned early on that the onset of schizophrenia or manic depressive disorder tends to be in adolescence, late adolescence, 17 or 18. And I'm wondering, how or if we have evidence that it manifests itself earlier. And in this case, I'm talking about a nephew who has been diagnosed with pervasive development disorder, or they talk about Asperger's syndrome. But then, you know, there's also talk that this is how manic depressive disorder manifests itself when kids are kids, little kids. And so they put him on lithium as well as a host of other drugs, and he's, you know, actually pre-adolescent.
Oh, well, sure. Certainly young kids can get hit by manic depressive illness. The age 17 or 18 is an average age,
right?
Which means that many people will be hit much younger, and some people will be hit later on in life. So there's no question that you know, kids as young as 2 or 3 have been diagnosed. Now that's relatively rare to have it diagnosed that young, but certainly in children and in young adolescents, bipolar illness is possible.
Does it get misdiagnosed as other things, and are the treatment options the same for children as they are for adolescents and adults?
Well, it certainly can be misdiagnosed as being just depression. Occasionally it's misdiagnosed as being attention deficit disorder. And it's very important that the diagnosis be correct because the treatments are very different. You don't really want to, by and large, be giving stimulants to a child who has bipolar illness, for example.
Right.
But the treatments are quite similar in young people as to what they would be for adults. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence of the importance of psychotherapy as well as medications. But there are a number of medications that are very effective in bipolar illness and in depression and in schizophrenia. But there's also quite a bit of evidence that the combination of psychotherapy and medication is better than either one alone.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to another caller here. This is Eureka, line 4. Hello.
Hi, I have a question regarding children's depression. In a child who says that, for example, they want to kill themselves when they're being corrected or they're being disciplined, and upon further inquiry, the answer is, well, I don't like being told what to do, so that would get me out of this situation. Is that something to take serious, or is that just a child's way of trying to deal with authority figures?
Well, I would take it seriously, certainly. I would take it seriously if just on the chance that the person's talking about death as an extreme response for whatever reasons, and I would be somewhat concerned about that. And then obviously there are a whole set of concerns if it's just being used to raise the emotional level in the room to get out of something. That's a whole different level of concerns. It would be very hard to know, you know, without obviously knowing the situation.
And is that, who is the appropriate person to talk with regarding that? Is a psychologist, a psychiatrist, social worker?
Well, anyone. You know, I think you want to make sure that whoever it is that you see has experience in diagnosing and treating the common, you know, psychological disorders of childhood and adolescence, and most particularly including depression, you know, and just inquire. People, I think, should always inquire before they see anyone, whether it's a social worker or a psychologist or psychiatrist, what their specialization is, what they treat, what they're comfortable treating, how much experience they have. You know, you want to do a little bit of background work on that.
Okay. Thank you.
All
sure,
right. Thanks. And again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. When people look at the kind of statistics that we've cited, and there are others, you know, for example, the one that I mentioned, suicide rate for white males, 15 to 24, tripled since 1950, or for suicide rate for African American males, 15 to 19, increased by 100% just in the last 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Suicide rate for 10 to 14 year old kids doubled since 1980. What they will say is that what this tells you is something about just how stressful adolescence has become. And they will also say that it is something of an indictment of our culture, our popular culture.
Right. I think that that's, you know, probably an oversimplification. I think adolescence has probably always been a difficult time for people. And I think that, you know, if you look at history, every generation thinks the current generation is under more stress, or the young generation. And in many respects, it would be hard to argue that adolescents are really under more stress than kids growing up in you know, abject poverty and having to work in the fields, you know, 14 hours a day. I mean, I think that there are a lot of other things that are going on, and it's a phenomenon that is true across, you know, Western Europe and many, many countries across the world. Some of that increase is a small part of that is probably because we're more accurate in calling something a suicide that, you know, 20 years ago someone might have called an accident in order to, quote, protect a family.
Mm-hmm.
So that a little bit of that increase is due to that. Some of it is there is a genuine increase in depression, and that we know that the average age of onset of these illnesses is probably going down, so that kids are getting psychiatrically ill younger than they used to. Puberty has, you know, gone down. The age of puberty has gone down strikingly. So that, that since these illnesses are tied to, the onset of these illnesses is tied to some extent to the onset of puberty, the very fact that the puberty, age of puberty has gone down so much also has a definite effect. Also, the things that we know have a tendency to really exacerbate or precipitate the first really bad depressive or manic episodes, alcohol and drugs. Kids have easier access to drugs and alcohol that can do that. Likewise, easy access to, you know, firearms and so forth. So there are a lot of very complicating factors.
Hmm. Again, we have other callers. So the next is Champagne, and it's line one. Hello.
Yes, this may be a little bit oblique to the main thrust of this discussion, but I was wondering if your guest would comment upon the increasing frequency of diagnosing someone with ADD and the increasing frequency of prescribing Ritalin as a solution to that problem. I'll hang up then.
Okay, it is a little bit outside my bailiwick. There obviously are concerns in some quarters about the over-prescribing of Ritalin, the possible over-prescribing. I think the evidence is still that in many parts of the country, kids are not diagnosed early enough for ADD, for the attention deficit, that in other parts of the country there's a concern that, in fact, they may be being over-diagnosed. I think this is something that is going to have to be really closely followed. It is a public health issue, and I think as a society we really need to track why we're giving medications to kids. And at what age should we begin doing that? Are there alternatives? But there are certainly a lot of kids that really need these medications. There's no question about that, that they really benefit from it, and it's very helpful. But I think it would be naive to say that there isn't some evidence that there is overprescription. And I think what is going to happen over the next 10 years or so, hopefully, is that, you know, the government and researchers are going to be addressing that issue very aggressively to try and figure out what's going on.
Another caller. This is Urbana. It's line two. Hello.
Yeah, three questions. Is it not particularly bad for young males?
Yes. In this country, suicide in young men is about four times as common as in young women.
And I understand that some people believe that, at least, and I was wondering if you do, that socioeconomic status is not really related to suicide at all. Do you believe that, too?
Yes, for the most part, that's true.
And the other question, last question is, I've also read that when a kid is younger than his classmates, that he's at greater risk for he or she is at greater risk for suicide, too. Is that, do you find that?
I'm not aware that that's true. No, I don't know that that's really been studied very systematically.
Okay. Okay. Well, can I stick one more in there?
Sure.
I also heard that just recently that there's been some findings that children in non-biological families where they are either the stepchild or an adopted child might be having are more prone as well. Any study there?
No, not that I'm aware of in terms of suicide, no.
Okay. Well, thanks.
I think the major tie really is to depression and a few other psychiatric illnesses.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
And again, other questions are certainly welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Just to follow up on this gender issue, I think that one of the things that we have heard, and I believe you addressed this in the book, is that One of the differences between girls and boys, or men and women, is that while women may actually attempt more often, that men are more successful because they choose the more violent means. Is that correct, or does that
start? That's correct up to a point, but it certainly varies from country to country. And in this country, actually, 60% of all suicides in both men and women are through firearms. Hmm. It is true that women overdose more often. Partly, it may be for a number of reasons, but also women are more likely to have been prescribed medications than men and to have sought treatment. So that's one thing that we know. But in countries, for example, like China, where women overdose on pesticides in the fields, the pesticides are so lethal that, in fact, their suicide rate is equivalent or greater than that of men.
And so we're talking about intentional, that is a means, intentional use of
yes.
taking of? Okay.
Absolutely, yeah.
And just for a second, going back to the issue of drug and alcohol, mm-hmm. And that being a contributing factor or a risk factor, is what's going on there that the drug and alcohol use is in a sense a symptom, and that people are trying to medicate themselves, or is it also a cause?
Both. In depression and in manic depression, there's a very high rate of associated drug and alcohol use, and a lot of that does seem to be to try and self-medicate, which is often disastrous. But we know that if you have an underlying depressive illness and you drink or use drugs, the drugs and drinking really do a lot of things that make it much more likely that you will kill yourself. First of all, it tends to make the illness much worse. It exacerbates the symptoms. It really plays havoc with sleep, which is very important to good mental health, and it undermines the efficacy of the medications that are used to treat depression and bipolar illness. So there are any number of ways that it can really make both the symptoms worse and the long-term course of these illnesses worse. Hmm.
Next caller is in Urbana. It's line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
I work with teenagers, and I work in a local prevention program for high school kids that's been around here for about 20 years. I want to ask you about behaviors that are not so overtly suicidal, such as, you were just talking about drug use, but smoking,
mm-hmm.
drinking and driving, unprotected promiscuous sex, things like that. What do you think about things like that in terms of suicidal behaviors?
I think they're important. I think it gets more speculative about what's really going on in terms of motivation and why people do it. I mean, there certainly is some evidence that people are more depressed or more likely to smoke. People are more depressed or more likely to drive recklessly and drink, so that they get very woven in together. And the whole question, like with high-risk sports or high-risk sex, that there is the same kind of impulsive risk-taking temperament that goes into some of those behaviors also we know is much more likely to result in a suicide attempt or suicide if you also have a depressive illness.
Mm-hmm. One other question, and this is sort of relevant because there was a concert, I think it was last night, the rap star Eminem and Limp Bizkit, and people who attract a lot of anger because of the lyrics of their songs. Now, and this is a question that also has to do with adolescents who oftentimes exaggerate to the point of, making lots of people angry.
Mm-hmm.
But in some sense, it seems like it's a healthy exaggeration because it's the expression of that kind of anger as opposed to taking that, those feelings and turning them against yourself or against somebody else physically. Do you have any comment on that?
I think that's probably true up to a point, but I think it's very hard to say. I mean, what we do know is, again, that people who are inclined to depression, for example, who also are angry, those people are at higher risk for actually killing themselves than people who are perhaps just depressed. So anger gets tied in a very negative sort of way to completed suicide when it's in the context of depression. But, you know, I think the expression of anger in adolescence is pretty pervasive in most kids at one time or another, and certainly to suggest that it's all negative or not adaptive would be really pushing it.
And that, of course, is the art of this, is trying to separate what's the healthy anger from the...
Exactly, and I think that, you know, again, I think focusing on disorders like depression, which are, you know, not uncommon disorders, and trying to kind of ferret that out from adolescence is a really important task.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you.
Okay. Just again to mention that we have about 10 minutes left, and to remind people who are listening or might have just joined us, our guest is Kate Redfield Jamison. She's professor of psychiatry at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. She's written a lot about mood disorders and suicide, and she's the author of the book Night Falls Fast, Understanding Suicide. It is published by Vintage in paperback, and the special focus of the book is suicide in people who are under 40. We have several other folks here. We'll keep going. Going next to our line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Okay. I'm calling about my mother. She is very angry. She's definitely depressed. I'm pretty sure she's bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
I have, you know, talked to her before and about going to see a psychiatrist or something, and she totally flipped out on me. So... I guess what my question is how would I go about in a way that she won't be defensive to talk to her about that?
Okay, you know, you're bringing up one of the hardest things to deal with. It is really difficult to try and talk to somebody who is denying that they have a major kind of psychological problem, and anyone who's been there knows how difficult it is. There are a couple of possibilities. One is that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't work, is to take the sort of strategy that one might do with somebody who has an alcohol or drug problem, which is, quote, do an intervention. It very seldom works to just have a one-to-one discussion because the denial and anger can be overwhelming for the one person, which it sounds like it was for you.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes getting a group of people, other family members, people from work, friends, a group of people together to discuss this with an individual and to say, you know, look, we're really concerned about you, we really love you, and here are the specific things, the specific behaviors that are causing us to be concerned about you. We'd really like you to get help, and then try and, you know, have a kind of a game plan for what that help might be.
Yeah, that's what my husband had suggested.
Uh-huh.
The problem is, though, that, you know, and I went through a phase myself that I defended her.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they do the same thing. I have two brothers and a sister. And
Does she have any friends that you could deal with?
No, not really. Her brothers and sisters, though, I mean, they do believe she has a problem, too.
Then you know, I would draw upon the people who, you know, are concerned, as you are, about her. Another thing I would do is, for yourself, you know, go to a support group. Like the, you know, the National Depressive and Manic Depressive Association, which is based here in Chicago, or the National Alliance for Mentally Ill, which has its national headquarters in Arlington, Virginia, have local support groups for families. And families very, very often have been through exactly what you're describing. And they will have strategies or suggestions that might be very helpful and also might be a source of support for you. And education, and I think that sometimes can be very, very helpful.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time.
All right. Best of luck. We'll go on here to another caller in Urbana, line 3. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
I'm bipolar. I was diagnosed schizophrenic originally about 1982 or so, and I'm an alcoholic besides being bipolar is what my diagnosis is now. And I'm curious as to know if drug addicts or alcoholics, because it's not casual usage, should be classified as a mental illness. And that's all I have to say.
Well, it is, I mean, just from a kind of an arbitrary, and not so arbitrary, but I mean, just from a professional point of view, they are classified as mental disorders in the sense that they are listed among the mental disorders in the kind of classification system that's used by psychologists and psychiatrists and social workers. It's, you know, it's, there's been a long debate about whether, you know, these are, quote, medical disorders or not. I think the evidence is pretty strong and accumulating that there's a very strong genetic component and that they are also often related to other conditions that have very strong biological roots to them. I think the important thing is, whatever it is, to get really aggressive treatment for the alcohol and drug abuse. And if you have a psychiatric illness in addition to that, like bipolar illness, to really get treatment for both the illness and for the alcohol use, because it's really important that both problems be taken care of.
We'll try and do one more here. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Yes. I need to have some similarities and distinctions drawn between the three terms of bipolar, the manic depressive, and schizophrenia. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Sure. Bipolar illness is just a modern term for manic depressive illness. They're really the same thing, and they're used interchangeably. Schizophrenia and manic depressive illness is characterized by extreme changes in mood and in thinking and in sleep patterns and in energy patterns and in appetite, in any number of things that, you know, are severe enough over over a sustained period of time. It's a very genetic illness, very much runs in families. Schizophrenia is the other major, very severe psychiatric illness, and it's characterized by changes in thinking and in changes in motivation, and has quite different symptoms in many ways. In some ways, some of the symptoms are overlapping, but they're quite distinguishable illnesses for the most part. And, you know, both of them are treatable. For a long time, schizophrenia was less treatable than it is now, but there are quite a few very good treatments for schizophrenia now. They're both devastating illnesses if they are left untreated.
We are at the point where we've used our time for this hour, and we're going to have to stop. Again, I would remind people that if you'd like to read more on the subject, you can certainly look for the book that we've mentioned. It's titled Night Falls Fast, Understanding Suicide. It's now available in a paperback edition published by Vintage. And the guest, our guest, the author, Kay Redfield Jamison, she's professor of psychiatry at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Professor Jamison, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.